I'd like to welcome everybody to this presentation here on principles and AA tradition. My name is Steve. I'm an alcoholic. Normally I use my last name, but I'm going to practice the 11th tradition here. Our program agenda here is Bob is going to be speaking on code of ethics and core values. Darren is going to be speaking on inventory. Calvin, our delegate from Area 54, Conference Archives Committee. Then we're going to go into traditions and archives Q&A from the floor. We'll go through the traditions then, and there'll be some questions. What I'll ask you guys to do is, through the presentation, if you will mark down any questions that you want to ask, I'll have a chance to do that at the end. And then we'll take your questions and we'll have some discussion. So without any further ado, I'd like to go ahead and introduce our chair for this event, Bob L.
Well, I can't see the.
You got a new close friend, Bob.
Okay. I'm an archivist named Bob. And we reviewed the archivist code here that was written some many years ago by Wayne C. Grover, archivist of the United States, from 1948 to 1965. We have a moral obligation to preserve valuable historic records and current records with equal zeal. People have asked me, how do you get a good set of 50-year-old minutes? And I say, well, that's simple. You take last week's minutes, you put them in a proper folder, in a proper box, in a proper storage environment, you wait 50 years. So really, you know, if you're not doing some records management in your area and nobody else is, you're not going to have good minutes in 50 years. Diligent disposing of records as retaining them. When I think I'm no different than anyone else. When you started out, you took anything that came your way. But then you've got to make some decisions later on. You've got to be ready to be a decision. Protect the integrity. Like I said, if we're kind of cops, protect and serve. In order to serve, you have to be able to protect. It has to be there for other people to be able to see it. Promote access to the fullest extent, observing restrictions. There was a time when the supervisor of the archivist was an attorney. I didn't think that was a really good choice. I nicknamed the guy Stonewall at one time. And I wrote that in a memo in George, my service sponsor, George D. was rather upset about that. He called me up and read me the riot act, and I said, well, yeah, I kind of agree. But George was about to retire, and his last statement to me before hanging up was, of course, if he were to have a nickname, and he never finished this. Respond courteously with a spirit of helpfulness to requests. I mentioned I was married to a librarian, and she said, they do not judge the value of questions. They just try to answer them as best they could. Do not profit from any commercial exploitation of the records in their custody. I love collectors. Some of them are really good friends, but I hate people who pretend to be archivists who are actually collectors. You've got to make sure that what they're taking from you that's supposed to go to the archives gets to the archives. And freely pass on to colleagues the result of your search. You should be, it's a network. You should be helping each other. Next slide. Core values condense should allow wide access as wide as you can to your facility with restrictions. The next really is more for legal things, although it's really helpful. I was in a discussion in my area about there was one budget item that was greatly increased one year for a really good reason for having it greatly increased that year, but it stayed greatly increased. And I finally brought that to question without being able to point to it. I don't know what I could have done. You've got to let people know you have archives, advocacy. Diversity. This has been a big issue for me recently. You should seek the underdocumented. Look at your collection, say, who don't I have records of? And you should go out and try to get them. History and memory. Try primary. Wikipedia is not a primary source. But they do have a whole list of things usually at the bottom that may direct you to the primary sources they work from. Preservation. If you're a government agency, if you've got employees or things like that, there may be some requirements for you to keep certain items for a certain period of time. Professionalism, that's why we're here. Education. We try it. While we may not be professionals, some of us are, most of us aren't, we should try to conduct ourselves in a professional manner. This will this will encourage people to give you things if they know you're going to take care of them. Responsible custody, again, you should be judicious stewards of your collection. You have a responsibility there to do it. We have a praying hands up there. And the central office where I am sometimes will accept stuff on my behalf, some of which I would wonder about, and it had a thumb broken off. And I thought about it. Normally you wouldn't change something, but when Bedford Wednesday Morning owned that thing, it had an intact thumb. When they used it, it had an intact thumb. They may have given it to us because the thumb got broken off. But I said, okay, we got to put a thumb back on, because we can't display this without a thumb back on. And normally I wouldn't have wanted to do that, but that's what we did. It would have been cheaper to buy another one like it, but it wouldn't have been Bedford Wednesday Mornings. Choices on preservation. You cannot preserve everything. You have to do a certain amount of triage. And know what you can take care of, what's most important. Service diverse users, including undocumented peoples. We don't check passports at our thing. Social responsibility, as Bill put it, so myth does not predominate over fact. Next. I think most of these are pretty well. I've got to read them because we're being taped here. Cooperate, professional relationships, collaborate, respect other archives and archivists. Gail taught me this. Our area archives lives in the same building as the Akron archives. We do not try to duplicate each other. You have to judge on what you'll take, and because you're responsible to take care of it. more elements here. This was in your packet. There's a reference, a list that points to these things. It comes from the Society of American Archivists. I would give you a web page list, except I don't have it here, and it's subject to change. That subject to change is referred to as lake rot. It's a different kind of mold, if you will. One of the reasons we're kind of careful about copyright on some issues is authenticity. There have been cases where people have removed paragraphs from memos and it has changed the meaning. Security and protection. We need to guard this stuff, and we need to have some idea about what we do if a flood comes or something like that. What will be the procedures there? Once it has happened, it's not a good time to make that plan. Access and use, minimum restrictions, maximum ease of use. Privacy. If somebody gives you something and says, if it's Lois's diary and it's in a bottom drawer and you're told you can't go in there, don't go in there. I would think the bottom drawer ought to be locked. Trust. We mentioned conflict of interest, taking unfair advantage. Okay, I think that's it. Right?
Thank you, Bob. Our next presenter is Theron, and he's going to present on Archives Committee Group Inventory.
Hi, everybody. I'm Theron. I'm an alcoholic, too. And I'm currently serving on the Area 58 Archives Committee. I just moved out to Oregon in the spring of this year, about 6 months ago, and went looking for some service work, and they kindly took me in because I told them I was willing to do some of the grubby stuff. So, what I'd like to talk about is a draft of an Archives Committee Group Inventory. And the way this came about was, if you remember at the International, those of you who were there, I had the opportunity to speak for a little bit about some project management, process management principles that are real helpful, very practical kinds of tools that we can use. And one of those is taking an inventory. I'm talking about the plan, do, check, act cycle. And the checking part means you check your work, check and see how the project is going. You just check, are you getting the kind of results out of your committee that you really wanted to get? So after giving that talk, I realized, like, wow, we don't have any way of checking. I just went on at great length about how what a good thing this would be, and we don't have such a thing. So I drafted these up. And kind of using the AA group inventory, the generic one, as a basis, but tried to make it more specific to archives. So this is in draft form, and I would very much welcome any feedback from people, because I just going over it again, I see like, oh, I'd change that, oh, I would add this, but this is a draft, and the techies among us are talking about putting up some kind of a sharing place on the internet, not a website, but kind of a discussion and document exchange kind of a place where we can do these sort of things. And it can evolve and be made certainly much better. But with that in mind, I'd like to start into this. Number one is, what is the basic purpose of our group? Now, that's kind of a loaded question. We know Tradition 5 says the basic purpose of any AA group is to carry the message. Do we have a written mission statement or other document to guide our work? A mission statement might sound like an unnecessary formality, but I found them real useful in projects where we'll get into a project and we'll start thinking of all kinds of neat things we could do, and we run off in all kinds of weird directions, and sooner or later come back to the mission statement and go, oh, okay, well, we don't need to do that. That's not in the scope of our mission here. So it helps to keep us online. It reminds us of what's important. Number two, what more can our group do to carry the message? Do our public displays attract and inform members about our local origins, history, and AA principles? And this kind of gets back to what Gail was talking about. We have a tendency, I think, and this is, I think there's a little bit of collector in all of us. We want to show, like, wow, this is all the stuff we have. And isn't it great? We have all this stuff. But if we're not telling a message, carrying the basic AA message with it, and showing the development of the AA fellowship and the principles, and particularly in our own areas and districts and groups, then we're really not addressing the basic reason for all of this. Number three, do we adequately include the local origins and history of AA among minorities? If we get people who are not like us coming into our groups and they don't see themselves in the materials we have on display, they're not going to be attracted. And we particularly want to attract them to AA, but we also definitely want to attract them into archives work, because we can use all the volunteers we can get. Number four, do we attract, train, and motivate committee members so they become committed contributors? And again, Gail mentioned, and I've found it true, that if you give people things to do and show them how they can be useful, it's a lot better than just making them sit through a committee meeting. So I was the archives chair for Area 32 for a while. And what I started doing was we had scanned a whole bunch of area minutes that were in the possession of someone else. The area didn't own its own history. So we scanned all these minutes, thousands of pages. And then at the archives committee meetings, I would bring in photocopies of those, or printed out copies, and pass around and give everybody a marker, a highlighter, and say, go through these things and mark out keywords. You know, a keyword could be like, in this year we determined how we were going to reimburse delegates for their travel expenses. Or in another year we determined who the officers were going to be and whether they're going to have voting rights, and, you know, things like that. So they would go through and mark them up, and then I would put those into the index that we were building of what we had. We had all these minutes, and I could tell you, yeah, we had 1956 through the present, but if we wanted to find a topic, which, you know, comes up periodically, somebody will say, didn't we vote on that back 10 years ago or so? How do you find it? Well, we had scanned all this stuff. They were old, crummy photocopies of photocopies, and they would not scan into optical character recognition. So the best we could do was to put keywords into our records. And that's helpful.
I don't think we had quite enough of these.
Ah. Okay. Yeah, we had, 50 copies, I think. We can make more, and we'll be putting them up online. So, do we obtain, this is number five, do we obtain and provide training for the archivist, conservator, and other committee members to effectively carry out their duties? As has already been mentioned, I found that the Historical Society in my area, I joined the Historical Society of Michigan when I was in Area 32, and they were great. They had all kinds of workshops about every other month, and on everything from preserving photographs to organizing collections, indexing, just all kinds of useful stuff. And that's good training. There's training on the website. GSO has given us a whole bunch of great training materials. So we need to suck this in from wherever we can, because good ideas are not it just from one source. Are we careful to preserve the anonymity of AA members, both living and deceased, at the level of press, radio, films, television, and new electronic media, including the Internet? I'm a web guy. I like to make websites. And in Area 32, I was not only the archives chair, I was the webmaster. And that's a dangerous combination because I wanted to put everything up on the web. And I had to restrain myself, and fortunately my committee was helpful with that too. As we went through these things, like, I can't put the minutes up on a web because there's everybody's names in them. We can put some pamphlets, some background history about AA, but there are a lot of things that we just can't share at that level. Do committee members willingly participate in work projects? And that gets back to motivating them, showing them that there's something that they can do that is actually helpful and constructive and moves the project forward. Are all significant decisions related to archives made by an informed group conscience? Gail talked about that some. And it's our job, I think, as archivists and as archives chairpersons, to help to educate our committees and tell them what these things mean, what the questions mean that are coming up. So give them a little background. Anonymity was mentioned, you know, and I've heard a lot of people say, oh, well, they're dead, it doesn't matter now. So we can educate them on the conference advisory actions. Do we provide secure storage locations for archival holdings that are safe from heat, fire, water, light, and insect damage, and that's not in a member's home, or worse yet, in the trunk of their car? That's been done. Fairly obvious, but this is part of this question is how do we differentiate between what is a collection that belongs to a person and what is the archives that belongs to your group. If it's in somebody's home, it's already suspect, and it may not be labeled clearly. That's another good reason to catalog everything, and another good reason for a deed of gift so we have documentation as to what belongs to the group and what may have been brought out of the best intentions. Like, oh, I got these great old big books, and I can bring them and show them along with the archive stuff. I've been not involved, but in the aftermath of exactly that kind of situation where a collector had to extricate his stuff from some other materials, and then there was a lot of hard feelings because, oh, he stole this from the archives, and he said, no, it's my stuff. Well, you know, we don't need controversy like that, so by being clear in our minds and clear in our documentation and clear in our storage, we can prevent that. Does the committee work to increase awareness of the archives and of AA history at the group and district levels by bringing displays to local events and conducting workshops at the local level? That was another thing the Historical Society was great at, was they had several workshops about making effective displays. Because most of the members of the Historical Society were kind of at the same level as us. They were working with a few volunteers and really limited budgets. When I joined them, I thought it was all going to be, you know, some big statewide archives that was going to be in there. But it was mostly like your hometown Historical Society. You know, a foundation bought a house, and they had some pictures of the guy who settled that small town. And so the archivist, the historian who's operating that, is underpaid, has to deal with volunteers who are semi-skilled at best, and they have little or no budget. So very much like where we're coming from. Very helpful to be in their seminars because they're at a real practical, down-to-earth level. Does the committee have ongoing projects to collect old-timers' oral histories and group histories? Are there other active historical research projects? Man, Area 33 has just been going gangbusters. I don't see them here today, but they've been going gangbusters on doing library research and going to hospitals and everywhere they can think of and turning up information about the history of AA in Detroit. And I think they're a terrific example of that. And old-timer oral histories, they're a stitch to do. I don't know why people are shy about interviewing old-timers, because it's a lot of fun. Does the group have clear financial policies regarding reimbursing legitimate expenses with prior committee approval and not purchasing acquisitions? This is another thing where we can avoid controversy by being clear and organized and having it written down in our guidelines. Which leads us to, does the committee have written guidelines and procedures to aid the archivist and volunteers in performing basic tasks? Is there a written collection scope? That's been talked about. Is a deed of gift or equivalent used to document acquisitions as part of the accessioning process? A good deed of gift will have several sections in it, and I've got one I'll show tomorrow. It talks about who owns the rights to the document, who owns the copyright, and what the terms are that it's being handed over under. The donor has to understand that the archives can do pretty much whatever they want with it within the limits of anonymity. So if it needs to be deaccessioned, it's going to be deaccessioned. Are these reviewed periodically and revised as needed? Number 14, does the archivist maintain a written inventory of holdings such as a finding aid? As Gail said, you know, many of us went through the stage where, oh, yeah, I know where everything is. And then eventually you don't, either because the collection has grown or, in my case, I've gotten older and I forgot. It happens. So a written finding aid also helps when we rotate out. We may not rotate that often, but am I going to impart all of my memory to my successor? I don't know how to do that other than writing it down. And that way, if somebody wants to research the history of our area, it doesn't need to be an outsider and we're worried about, are they going to have access to this? It could be the archives committee wants to research it. But if we don't have a finding aid, we're not going to know where the information is. And finally, does the archives respect the copyright limitations on the holdings in the collections? And I think there'll be more on that later, too. So that's what I got. And as I said, I think the techies are going to post this. I welcome input. There's certainly improvements to be made to it, but I think it's a start and something that we need to think about. So thank you.
Thank you, Darren. And my next speaker is Calvin Hill, Delegate Area 54, member of the Conference Archives Committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Calvin Hill, and I serve as a delegate for Panel 65, Area 54, Northeast Ohio. I serve on the Policy and Admissions Committee, and more importantly for this workshop, for the Archives Committee. You know, when you're at the conference, you always have to use your first and last name through the whole session. So it's different today. When I went to the conference, prior to going to the conference, I was assigned to the Archives Committee. And when you get there, you get a notebook. This is the notebook I received for the Archives Committee. It has a plethora of information in it, and in it, there is an agenda, the committee list, composition, scope, and procedures, history, and highlights of actions, and report of the trustees, and then the agenda items. I'm just going to talk about my experience because I'm a novice in this archives. Because the first time I really learned about archives was when they assigned me to this committee. And I had to read the workbook, and I was, like, overwhelmed. And I'm overwhelmed today with all the information that I've learned, and last night also. So I'm just going to tell you a few things here. I'm going to read a lot of it because I'm not giving you my opinion. I'm telling you the facts as I received them, okay? Okay, archives. The Trustees Archives Committee was established by the General Service Board and held its first meeting in October 1973. Through its group conscience and guided by AA principles and procedures, and professional standards, the committee undertakes and upholds responsibility and authority for the maintenance and use of the archives. In 1998, it was recommended that a conference archives committee composed of 9 delegates meet at the 49th General Service Conference as a secondary committee assignment, and that the committee meet jointly with the trustees archives committee. You know, last night I found out that Gail and Bob were instrumental in getting this advisory action put through so that we do have a conference committee on archives, and it came out of this workshop. So it's amazing. It's just amazing. So composition. There are not more than 9 voting members on this committee and a non-voting secretary, Michelle. Members of this committee will serve as a secondary committee assignment and not as a primary committee assignment. The members of this committee will include not more than 5 delegates from the previous year's panel and not more than 5 delegates from the current year's panel. Scope of the committee. 1. Discuss the report of the Trustees Archives Committee and make recommendations on archival policies. Procedure, to meet jointly with the Trustees Archives Committee during the General Service Conference. 2. Make recommendations, if any, reached by majority vote to the entire conference. 3. To present recommendations to the conference for approval, disapproval, or amendment in a report given by the committee chairperson. 4. To maintain correspondence with committee secretary and other committee members during the year. And 5. To review the available archives literature. So, the joint meeting of the Conference and Trustees Committee on Archives met on April 22nd, 2015, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. We only meet once, unless there is so much that we have to schedule additional time. I guess we could do that if we had to. But the other committees, they meet with their trustees, and then they have additional meetings, conference committee meetings. But this is a secondary committee and only meets once with the trustees. There are introductions at the committee meeting by the trustees committee chairperson, and we review the committee composition, scope, and procedure, which I just told you about. And then Michelle gives us a review of history of the conference committee. And I just want to read a couple things that happened in the history just for the last couple of years, and we've heard about some of them. In 2013, it was recommended that the archives video Markings on the Journey be revised and updated with the proposed changes, estimated cost $5,000, and brought back to the 2014 Conference Archives Committee. Also, a commemorative 75th anniversary edition of the first edition, first printing of Alcoholics Anonymous, be published in April 2014. And both of those things were done. And in 2014, it was recommended that the video Markings on the Journey be approved. It was approved, and they were showing that Markings on the Journey yesterday, in the afternoon over in the amphitheater. Let's see here. And then we received the trustees' committee report. So I just want to give you a few things that were on the trustees' committee report. And item 1, the committee supports the GSO Archives' commitment to permit access to members of Alcoholics Anonymous and others. The committee, since 2014 General Service Conference, granted permission to 9 researchers for use of archival material. The permission also included access to archival audio recordings for limited use. Each request is carefully considered through recommendations from the archivist and established archives policy. This is important. It's been talked about. The permission to conduct research is granted conditional on a signed agreement to strictly maintain the anonymity of all members alive and deceased, including AA's co-founders. So it's important to maintain anonymity, And it's talked about in the committee, it's in the workbook, and it's an important part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm glad a lot of people talked about anonymity still exists even when you're gone, you're dead, you still have your anonymity. Okay, item two. In considering a research request to consult recordings of the General Service Conferences, the committee requested that the archivist prepare historical background on the 1984 advisory action regarding General Service Conference recordings. And it read, tapes of conference presentations not be made available, affirming the 1979 General Service Board recommendation, which prohibits making tapes of any conference session for distribution outside of the AA archives, except for the opening and closing brunch. So the archivist did background on that, Michelle. She's very busy. And here's an excerpt from one of her reports. She says, the 1984 action refers to a 1979 General Service Board recommendation. However, it is uncertain whether such a recommendation was expressed by the board. There is a single reference to the conference tapes that is found within the summary of the committee's report, section of the July 30th, 1979 Service Board's committee minutes. And so, a summary of her findings, two sentences. It says, I did not find a clearly expressed General Service Board recommendation of 1979, and I did not find any conference advisory action that predates 1979 regarding the conference tapes. So, following review and discussion of the report, the committee recommended the following revision, and they were going to submit it to the Policy and Admissions Committee. And it reads, recordings of General Service Conference presentations be made available for distribution in accordance with archives policies to include audio recordings of keynote presentations, other selected presentations, talks from opening dinner AA meeting, and the trustees' farewell talks given at the closing brunch. Access to all other General Service Conference sessions will continue to be prohibited. So, I served on the Policy and Admissions Committee, so I got to talk about this. And we invited Michelle, and she came in and gave us direction. By the way, she likes to give direction. And so we came up with a more concise statement, which was less ambiguous. So here it is. Audio recordings of General Service Conference presentations published in the General Service Conference final report and audio recordings of the trustees' farewell talks given at the closing brunch be made available in accordance with all archives policies. Access to all other General Service Conference sessions will continue to be prohibited. We recommended that to the conference, and it passed with some substantial unanimity, so that is the policy now. Thank you, Michelle. And the last excerpt from the trustees' report was, the committee asked the archivist to share on how digital material are managed in the archives, and the archivist noted that the archives' deed of gift form should be amended to include an addenda for accepting digital items. And they are supposed to meet in August. Well, they probably already met to talk about that, the trustees committee. So we accepted the report of the trustees committee. Our committee made no, the archives committee made no recommendations to the conference. We had two considerations, though, and they were as follows. The committee reviewed the contents of the archives workbook, noting minor editorial changes in a new section, sharing on digital archives, which will provide sharing and suggestions for archives committees. And the other consideration was the committee discussed the shared experience section in the archives workbook, which is refreshed every 5 years. The committee suggested including experience shared by local archivists and archives committees on where archives are housed, associated costs, access procedures, and description of contents. And that's what we did. And then we had an election. And all panel 65 members are eligible except for the 2016 delegate chairperson and 2016 conference committee chairperson. All committee members vote by ballot, written ballot, and there are no nominations. And election is by plurality, and second place becomes the alternate chairperson. So the new chairperson serves 1 year beginning at the end of the conference, and the committee elected Christopher S., delegate for Area 91, Saskatchewan, chairperson, and Calvin L., delegate for Area 54, Northeast Ohio, is the alternate chair, and that closed out our committee. And it was a wonderful experience. Thank you. You know, I just want to say one more thing, and it really touched me when I read this in the, I hope I can find it since it touched me. It's out of the workbook, and it says, and it's by Bill W., it says, "We are trying to build up extensive records which will be of value to a future historian. It is highly important that the factual material be placed in our files in such a way that there can be no substantial distortion. We want to keep enlarging on this idea for the sake of the full-length history to come." Thank you. And I'll sit down.
Thank you, Calvin. As I said earlier, my name is Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. And I previously served as area archivist for North Florida Area 14. And I've also been a past district archivist for District 13. I currently serve as a DCM for my district, District 13. And I want to thank the committee for asking me to come up here and participate in this. I'm always happy to and energetic and ready to serve in any way possible and be all we want to be as a part of, right? I had an opportunity to kind of do the same thing at the International, and after it was over, we had three speakers, two of them were here today. There were certain specifics, and when I got done, somebody came over to me and said he thought I talked a little bit too much. So that's why I wanted to make sure that our three panel members got to go first. The last portion of this is and Gail talked about it earlier, is, you know, how do we don't talk enough about the traditions and how we equate them to archives. And I will tell you, I came a long way. When I got elected as archivist for my area, it was, I knew about collecting, and I loved history, and I knew about stuff. And I had no idea, just like when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. I had no idea what an archivist was really all about. And I found out very quickly when I attended my first National AA Archives workshop in Macon. And this is my sixth one now. And it's people like Bob and Farron and Gail and Don and that, you know, it teach me about ethics and the core values and what's really important in archives. And so in getting into the traditions, what I've done here is I've tried to integrate some questions into each tradition. Some of the things that just came to my mind, it's said that the traditions are what, you know, it's a spiritual glue that holds Alcoholics Anonymous together. And hopefully that's the spiritual glue that holds us together as archivists in our work. I'm going to try to go through this quickly. I want to find out real quick, how many people have questions already? All right, then I'll slow down a little bit. So tradition one, AA's 12th tradition repeatedly asks us to give up personal desires for the common good. You know, I always got to check my ego at the door here. Tradition one is all about unity. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. I love the cartoon we did here because, you know, I'm a visual person, so I understand this, you know. The group is pulling this guy out of the water. But really, when I looked at it and really wanted to know what the meat and potatoes and the traditions were all about, I always had to look at the long form. And it said that each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. AA must continue to live, or most of us will surely die. Hence, our common welfare comes first. But our individual welfare follows closely afterwards. And, you know, when I read that, that really explains the whole tradition to me. And another cartoon I love here, you always got one guy in your home group here, and this guy, everybody sits on the branch, and he's gonna saw them all off. So he thinks that's what's best, I guess. But here's one of the questions that I came up here, and is there unity in your archival work? Tradition two is all about group conscience, and this happens to me all the time. This particular gentleman over here is now he's elected secretary. He's going to show him some real leadership. And fellowship in my district are always going down board. So the question I came up with here is your archival work guided by group conscience? Or are you a committee of one? And I don't know about you, but like in my district, I would set up committee meetings and sometimes I would be the only one that showed up. But I always found that it's better to work through a group conscious than work for one person and making the decisions from everybody. And so I would constantly bring reports to my district or my area on what was going on and try to get their input. Tradition three, the only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking. And of course, it's all about membership. But again, in the long form of the third tradition, it talks about our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover, nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided it is a group they have no other affiliation. And so I thought about it and I thought, is your archival work open to all AA members in your community that want to participate in the service? Tradition four is about autonomy. And each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. And I love this one right down here about the Rosebud group. Free beer at the first meeting. Is your archival work guided by spiritual principles? I really had to think about that. I mean, is it really guided by spiritual principles, or am I just trying to show off, show what stuff I got and what I know? Tradition five is primary purpose. Each group has their own primary purpose to carry its message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And for Don, this is the guy who's got the key to willingness. So what is the primary purpose of your archival work? Is there a mission statement? What is your scope? Do you have a collection policy? And do you have a deaccession policy? So when I was archivist for the North Florida area, I picked up the archive storage from our predecessor. And we keep it in a controlled environment. We don't have a repository. So I took all the archives and I brought them to a new facility close to my house where I could do the work. And we had some old tapes. And the previous archivist looked at me and she said, "Well, those tables are old, you can just throw them out." "No, you can't throw them out, we don't have a deaccession policy." As I started to look, we didn't have a mission statement, we didn't have a scope, and we didn't have a collection policy at all. The only thing we had in place is that we collected stuff from the North Florida area and we kept the records and everything, but it was becoming very apparent to me that we were like, the thrift shop. Give us your four, your tires, your hungry, whatever you brought us, we took it, whether it fit our area or not. And so I'm gonna have to be honest right now. I started looking around. I looked in the workbook that Gail just got done talking about, the GSO workbook, and they had some stuff in there. And I started looking around online, and I saw one in Michigan that had a collection policy. And I started to draft a template for the North Florida area based on that one, because I was very impressed at the way that one was. And I believe now, I didn't know at that time, but that was the collection policy in Fairmont, I believe. So once I got this written, I took it before my area, and we posted it, and we got it passed. And now we have a collection policy. Now the North Florida area knows what they collect, they know what our policy is, and they also know we have the accession policy in there. And then I can get rid of those old tables. So tradition six is about non-affiliation, and says an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. And in the long form, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but right here it says, the problems of money, property, and authority may easily divert us from our primary spiritual aim. And I believe it's been talked about here earlier that, if sometimes we have people that mix their personal stuff in with their area or their district. Guilty. When I was district archivist, we had a very small district display, and we have a thing called community meeting that our intergroup puts on once a month, where one group in the area hosts it. And so the archives would always set up, and I have to admit, I slid some extra stuff in there to make the presentation look good. Or so I thought it would. But here, we think, therefore, that inconsiderable property of genuine use to AA should be separately incorporated in man, just dividing the material from the spiritual. And that was obviously something that I didn't understand when I did that, but I use these two right here because these are obviously two places, Dr. Bob's House and Stepping Stones, that are very dear to us in Alcoholics Anonymous, but yet they are private foundations outside here, not Alcoholics Anonymous, just like clubs, just like our AA golf teams. These are all private things. Run by AA for AA. So the questions I came up with for this tradition was, is our AA archive dependent on material, such as books and memorabilia, to tell our story? Or do we take care to preserve our local intergroup, district, and area documents? Do we take the time to document our local group and personal stories? And I believe that's been talked about. Do we mix our personal materials with our elected or appointed AA archives inventories? And like I just explained, guilty once. Tradition 7 is about self-support. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. I love this one right here because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, it taught me about how to be responsible with paying my bills. On the long form of the tradition at the bottom, it says, experience has often warned us that nothing can so surely destroy our spiritual heritage as field disputes over property, money, and authority. And I believe that was talked about just a little while ago. Somebody stuck a big book in the archive, and then they went to retrieve it, and they thought they were stealing. So the question I came up with here is, do we make sure to get a signed or notarized deed of gift when receiving donations from our members? And I think that's very, very important. It's been talked about a lot. Sometimes even deceased members, things are passed along, and families find out what a value a particular item is, and they want it back. And this is where the material and the the spiritual kind of hit that along. But if something is donated to us, then we should get it. We should get a notarized deed of gift, and then it belongs to the archive. So tradition eight is about non-professionalism, and says that Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. And in the long form of the tradition, it says we define professionalism as the occupation of counseling alcoholics for fees or hire. So I was wondering about this, and I consider myself an amateur, and I was thinking, as amateur archivists, do we do it for the love of archives and our love of AA? And my answer is yes. But as amateur archivists, are we and should we always be professional in our service work? And again, I think the answer is yes. Tradition 9. AA is such ought never be organized. But we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. And this is all about the spirit of service, which I learned right away when I came in. I believe many of us have been coffee makers there, and some of us in this room have had the honor and the privilege of serving as delegates or even trustees at that level of service. But somebody told me a long time ago the highest we can get in Alcoholics Anonymous is trusted servant. In the long form of the tradition, it says all such representatives are to be guided in the spirit of service, for true leaders in AA are the trusted and experienced servants of the whole. So I thought about this one, and I thought, are we guided by the spirit of service in our archival positions? Are we trusted and experienced servants? I think that's why we come here. Tradition 10. I love this one. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. And so we got a little cartoon guy here, and he's talking about how he's maintained his sobriety for 10 years, and now he's going to start speaking for AA. And he's starting to talk about outside issues, and he's going to send a telegram. And the next thing you know, that just starts causing controversy and chaos. And what ultimately happens is the newcomer walks away saying, how can anybody stay sober and outfit like that? So, do we strive to avoid outside issues in our archival work? Are we always in the middle of it? I don't know. Tradition 11. It's about anonymity. That's why I didn't introduce, one of the reasons I didn't introduce my last name. We're being recorded here today. And it says our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And of course, we don't want anybody to be a messiah for AA and get in front of the camera and start preaching. But we're not a secret society either. The long form of the tradition talks about it being attraction rather than promotion. And I was always one of these people who always thought, you know, unfortunately, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program not for everybody. It's for people who want it, not necessarily for those that need it. And I love what Dr. Bob said here. He says, by giving your name to the public, he says, there's two ways to break the anonymity tradition, by giving your name at the public level of press, radio, or by being so anonymous that you can't be reached by other AA members. And that's why I use my last name whenever I'm in a meeting. I want you to know who I am. So the questions I came up with here, are we able to attract others by our enthusiasm to join us in our archival service work? And that was something that was preached by some people that got me involved in AA, and service work in general was that we have to pass this on by our enthusiasm. I think that's what probably attracts people to ask us to be sponsors, is They see our enthusiasm and our love for alcohol is anonymous. Are we careful not to break the anonymity of our members, both living and deceased? And it was mentioned earlier about posthumous anonymity. We had a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous last year pass in Tampa, and his family or somebody decided to put his full picture and his whole story on the front page of the Tampa Bay Times. It wasn't him, although the man was not very anonymous because he was a circuit speaker. It was not him to put his last name out there. So tradition 12, and this kind of wraps it all up, is that anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Once again, sacrifice equals humility. When we choose the path of selfishness, greed, and pride, we are refusing to accept God's Spirit. When we choose the path of love and service, we accept God's Spirit and it flows into us. This we owe to AA Future, to place our common welfare first, to keep our fellowship united. For on AA unity depends our lives and the lives of those to come. Thank you. We're open for questions now. If anybody has a question, raise your hand. For being paid, I'll be happy to come over and speak to you the mic.
Oh, okay. You said something about not saying your life.
Hi, Eddie.
Oh, alcoholic preacher's group name is Eddie. From Toronto. You mentioned that you didn't use your last name, right? It's being recorded, but for AA purposes, right? And then Dr. Bob just said that we could be so anonymous in Alcoholics Anonymous that nobody knows us. So there's a contradiction there. I believe that a last name should be used in this scope because this is for within Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not outside. So I don't know, that's how I feel about it.
All right, well, if it's being recorded, we have no idea how, if that's going to get out on social media or on the internet. So if that was to happen, I would be breaking my anonymity. I'm sure that one of the delegates might want to weigh in on that, too.
Thank you so much. But I agree that even though this is for AA, it's not going to stay in AA. It's going to get out because it's recorded and it's on CDs. And so if you have CDs out there, people are going to copy them. They're going to give them. They are going to copy them, and they're going to give them to people. And you don't know where they would wind up. And so it's better to be safe. And so we remain anonymous. Thank you.
I downloaded a set of Joe and Charlie tapes off of xaspeakers.org, and I'm certain that Joe and Charlie did not intend that their talks were going to be posted on the internet. So we don't know where this stuff is going to go either.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thanks. I'm alcoholic. My name is Steve. Privileged to serve as the archive chair for Area 49, Southeast New York. I had a question about the location of the archives. You had mentioned that when you became the archivist, you moved the archives to a location near your house. So Area 49 is pretty large, and we have an office in the Bronx. It's pretty centrally located in the area. And the thought would be that the archives should be located near the office so that if we need to do archival work, we could do it at the office. For instance, I traveled from my house up to where the archives is now, which is in... it's north of the Bronx, I'll just say that. And then I had to go down to the office, do the work, and then bring the stuff back up. Is there any recommendation on where the archive should be located? We have it in a climate control, obviously. But is there any recommendation on where it should be housed?
Well, the only reason that the archives were located in the facility that I explained is because North Florida does not have an area office. We have a archives committee chair, and he takes what we call our rolling road show, and he takes that display around to different workshops. But we have other documents and things that need to be stored, and somebody cares for them, and that's the archivist. So it's all, we have to keep it in a climate-controlled area. So it's, we rent a storage facility, and that's where we keep it. There were, a number of years ago, we did try to open up a facility near where we keep our area assembly, but it was just too costly for the area. So we don't have a repository or an area office. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, in the context of this discussion about traditions, I don't see that there's any traditions that bear on that. It's a matter of what's convenient and what you can afford, and what's a suitable space.
I don't know on the traditions, but I'm young, I'm an alcoholic from Delaware. I have a question. Lately, obituaries are coming out where the families you vote for, they may have approved it before they died. When they talk about their AA involvement, if we preserve those articles, do we have any obligation to make them anonymous when they've already been put out there?
Anybody want to feel that one?
If you're preserving them in your archives, then they would be subject to the same restrictions as anything else in your archives. You presumably have other material in the archives that have last names. Right, because as somebody mentioned before, you could have several LLs. So in your historical data in your archives, you've got last names already. So if you preserve that obituary, it's subject to the same restrictions as anything else in your archives. It's unfortunate that sometimes families don't realize that that's probably not appropriate, but that's an outside issue because that's something they did, not us.
But I've also gotten to talk to granddaughters and nieces and nephews and trying to find that next of kin. But that's how I did this whole dead alcoholic and get permission to put their stories written and when I find them oral in that memorial album for them. That's that right?
I think as long as you don't use their last name, I mean, you can't circumvent that by going and talking to the granddaughter and the daughter and the niece. You still have to maintain their anonymity. I just read the thing about alive or deceased, we're anonymous. So, you know, just as long as you don't circumvent it to do your memorial to put their last name in there. Nothing is just available to alcoholics. I mean, unless it's in a room locked up and you got to show your Alcoholics Anonymous ID to get in. Otherwise, it's not just available to alcoholics.
Anybody else?
Mike H. Louisville, Inner Group, Archives Committee member. And the DX session, that's, you got too many copies of something. I just received some old Kentucky just to group information. Is there any model, is there any pattern that we've used as far as things that may be of value to someone? You just say, you know, does the archives checkers say, I want it, I'll take it? Or do you, how do you get rid of things that may be of value? Do you sell them? Do you have an open auction at a convention or what? How do you handle that?
I think we got an example in the past, but I think we all lost the letter.
It's in the workbook.
all of the things that you, all the options that you have, and it's all about policy. The policy is set up before that happens. You don't wait until it happens and then react. Try to look in the workbook, have your committee form a policy on how you will be accessioned, and then you won't even have the question, you'll have the policy.
George B. District 6, Illinois Area 21 Archives. When the lady mentioned that somebody got worked up, to me that's a signal that I need to respect that and back up. Because the attraction rather than promotion, you know, ultimately it's carried the message to alcoholics who still suffer. That person knows another alcoholic, and they know an alcoholic, and they know an alcoholic. So when I get, if I'm speaking with somebody, or I want to interview somebody, or want to do something for the archive, when I sense that someone's getting worked up or feels like I'm invading their space, or I need to back off so that I assure that attraction rather than promotion.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions?
My name is Alexander from the region 87 and the archivist on my district 22. I was just wondering, maybe I can understand the other things that the second names are not specified here because of the possibility of going on the internet. But I would like to know if you make sure that the second name here for the registered people are kept so that we can link that the people talking, okay, the man in front, yes, say yes, so you answer my question.
Man in front?
Well, this kind of bears on what Gail was saying. If we have policies within our archives about how we handle anonymous material, it's pretty much essential that we're going to have some last names in order to trace histories and be able to differentiate one Al from another Al. But we need to be sure we have a clear policy on how we handle that so it doesn't get out into the public. Calvin's point was real good, that it can be real slippery, and if we're not careful, it'll end up on the internet. So we don't just go lending things to people because they're curious.
Thank you, Darren.
I've got a probably about 3,800 cassettes.
And reels to reels. And a lot of them from back in the 40s, the 50s, and so on. And a lot of them use their last name. We found out that you can, if you're not going to make CDs, because reel to reel is obsolete and cassettes are also more or less, that you can block that last name out, keep the original, so that you have it and you know who it is, but you'll also know anyway because it should be on your, what CD you were making, and then you'll know who they are of it's Bill Smith, but not the Bill Smith.
Yeah, obviously a lot of people haven't done that. I mean, you can find speaker tapes on the internet that have full last names. But one way to differentiate that is when you block out the last name, you can use a code number. When we index things, oftentimes we'll put a unique code onto documents and files and that kind of thing so we can find them. And we can do that with tapes like that, where we don't have to try and guess, I got this tape and it sounds like it was LL, but if we code it so we know within the archives, and that coding then is a good practice for indexing.
Anybody else?
Comment, what you put up on the traditions and what you put up on the group inventory really kind of dovetail together. So that's kind of cool that those get worked in there and then it all comes together. So that's great.
Thank you. probably some of my thoughts came from seeing it, Darren's inventory question. So, one comment I wanted to make about the CDs. When I was archivist in the North Florida area, we had a huge box of cassette tapes, and really thought it was kind of a nice idea what we were going to do with them. We needed to reformat those. And this was before we had a scope, and I started a project to convert them all digitally over. But the further I got into it, it seemed that that wasn't, because of the cost, it wasn't in the best interest of the North Florida area at that time. The project kind of died because we're not in the business of collecting secret tapes or making. And then the question came up: even if we did this work and spent all the money, how would we distribute it? And possibly your idea of being able to take out the last name is a way to do that. But at the end of the day, it did not match our scope once we had a policy in place. The other thing is that a lot of the old timers, and when I went through and scanned our area minutes, we have a password protected area on our website where we post a lot of things, and we post our past minutes and structures and guidelines and things like that, and our current minutes. And once I'd gone through and scanned all the minutes, we couldn't put them up there, even though it was a password protected area, because a lot of our old timers, they use last names. So generally had to have a tech person kind of go in there and scrub them all out. Once they were scrubbed, then we were able to put them on there, on the password protected area, so that our people could go in and they could research whatever motions or whatever they needed to for past minutes. But it was a lot of work, and that's something that has to be understood. Any other questions or comments?
Yeah,
I can
make a comment.
Paul,
okay. My name is Donald. I'm the area archivist for Area 59 Eastern Pennsylvania. We have an archives committee appointed every 2 years. Approximately 4 or 5 years ago, the archives committee at that time came up with an archives policy guideline. Now, the committee changes completely every 2 years. I've been involved with the area archives for about 7 years. So, are these, is this policy?